The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. 602-508-0960 is the number. If you want to weigh in on anything we're talking about or bring up anything else you have on your mind that we're not talking about, we're here for that. We're here for you. Chris Llewellyn will happily take your call. He's our producer pro tem today. Bill will return tomorrow. I don't know if you're like me in this respect, but over the last week or so, have you noticed a little more concerted conservative outrage over what was being done and said with regard to Georgia than really a lot of other issues of late? Have you noticed conservatives have gotten particularly angry in their Irish up over this? You have senators from other states defending Georgia, et cetera, et cetera. You have national and local talk show talking about this thing. You have columns about it. It seems like more than any other issue in a while, conservatives have rallied and united on this Georgia story. And I was trying to figure out why. And I don't know that I have the right answer if my premise is right in the first place, that there is seemingly more attention on this than other things in a while. But if I'm right about that there is, I think it's because of something that exists fundamentally throughout the United States, left and right in many respects, but for sure throughout the right. And that is fundamental fairness. Offending fundamental fairness offends us almost more than anything else. They say truth is the first casualty of war, but it turns out we have learned that it's the first casualty of the left. We saw lie after lie, deliberate lie after deliberate lie, manifestly discoverable lie after manifestly discoverable lie, so much so that the Washington Post gave its ultimate number of Pinocchios, that is to say lie ratings, four of them, to Joe Biden in what he said about it so obvious was his lie about Georgia. The lie is so obvious. I think that is what is so offensive, or has become so offensive to us, that people are peddling on and literally trafficking financially and politically in out-and-out bald-faced lies. Bald-faced lies. And I think something like that rubs us more wrong or wrongly than anything else. Transparency is another issue. Used to be anyway. Transparency used to be another issue. I know it used to be because Joe Biden kept talking about it and everything when he was on the campaign trail. And almost everything Joe Biden talked about on the campaign trail was a used to be, was a distant memory, history. But transparency was something he promised going in to the new White House, as if there was some kind of major transparency problem with the Trump White House, by the way. There were any number of problems at the Trump White House, as there are at any White House. And I remember a lot of them. But was transparency really one of them? Was transparency a problem for the Trump White House? I mean, it's trite to say at this point, but it is eminently true that Donald Trump may have been the most transparent of presidents in the White House, given how much of the press he gave of himself. Interviews to ABC and Stephanopoulos and Woodward and, you know, long, long, long Q&A sessions with all members of the media from CNN to OANN. Transparency wasn't really an issue for the Trump White House, and he'll get no credit for it because it's not about the transparency. It's about the policy. It's about the ideology, just as in the case of the Democrats in Georgia, it's not about the truth. It's about the underlying policy to make it easier to swindle votes, to help do in Georgia what they're afraid they won't be able to get passed in the Senate, known as H.R. 1 or S.1. But as I said, if truth is the first casualty of war, it's also the first casualty of the Democratic Party. I give you this story from Breitbart. The Department of Homeland Security has erased a report that detailed illegal aliens on the Federal Bureau of Investigation's terrorism watch list and no-fly list crossing the United States-Mexico border. Get that? Two illegal aliens at our Mexican-American border were detained, and they were on the FBI's terrorism watch list. On Monday, yesterday, CPB, Customs and Border Protection, published a press release detailing the apprehension of these two illegal aliens. You're curious where they're from? They're from Yemen. Terrorists from Yemen coming in our border. The press release said, quote, two Yemeni men arrested by Border Patrol identified on the FBI's terrorism watch list, close quote. This morning, that press release is gone, memory hold, removed from the CPB website, and it has not been republished. A link to the original press release shows an access denied page. CPB officials did not respond to a request for comment. Is this not an incredible story? Why is this administration even maintaining the fiction of continuing to advertise if you see something, say something? They said something, the CPP did, and the Biden administration took it down because it's a bad political narrative. The idea that our border is so porous that would-be terrorists on our watch list can walk in from Yemen. And that the condition, of course, of the state of the world as anything but super safe because Joe Biden has calmed all the waters is also not the narrative they want. So you combine two things, dangerous world terrorism and an open or porous border under Biden, and you have a toxic confluence that they cannot have and they must memory hole. They must memory hole it. It's really quite incredible. The CPB report revealed also that on March 30th, Border Patrol agents in Southern California apprehended another illegal alien from Yemen. And guess what? When they did checks on his background, they found he too was on the FBI's terrorism watch and no-fly list. How would anyone know any of these things? Jen Psaki was asked about it and said the worst thing in the world. She said, first, let me convey that these sets of incidents are very uncommon. Does that help you to know that terrorist numbers coming into the United States are in these numbers are uncommon? Does that make you feel more comfortable? What did 19 do under our noses? I just gave you three. What did 19 do? Sets of incidents are very uncommon. The point is, if we have to be right all the time against terrorism, and they only have to be right some of the time, or one time, the idea that they are uncommon is a tremendous surrender. It's a tremendous surrender. Is it not? Of course it is. Of course it is. So, one of the things to note about Georgia and the conservative movement that has rallied behind it is that I think it might be the first testing ground of conservatives being able to turn back a narrative. I think MLB is a little bit on its heels. I think Delta is a little bit on their heels. I think Coca-Cola is a little bit on their heels because of so many objections to what they said. And if you want to move the few precious liberals that are left around in this world, if you want to lose them to the Republican Party, you'll do more of what Delta and Coca-Cola and MLB did. Because those liberals know what Jim Crow is. They know Jim Crow is gnashing dogs' teeth. They know Jim Crow is anti-miscegenation laws. They know Jim Crow is literacy tests. They know Jim Crow is segregated restaurants. And when they're told that a campaign committee can't give water to someone standing in line to vote in November, that that's Jim Crow 2.0, they know that that's a lie. 602-508-0960. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. 602-508-0960. My friend Solar Sandy is the one, Solar Sandy, who brought Integrity back to solar in Arizona. The difference between Solar Sandy and the other solar companies isn't just the Integrity. It's also that she figured out how to actually turn your power bill into zero, to truly zero out your power bill. It's so important when going solar, you do it the right way. And Solar Sandy has that formula. She wants to put more of your hard-earned money back into your pocket. When you go solar, Solar Sandy will pay 12 months of your solar payments, any portion of your power bill for the first 12 months. And because it's March Madness, Solar Sandy's promotion to the first 50 families is that they will receive a $1,000 signing bonus. That's right. No solar panel payments, no power bills for 12 months, and a $1,000 bonus at signing. There's no better time to go solar with Solar Sandy than right now. Go to AskSolarSandy.com. Again, that's AskSolarSandy.com. Tell her I sent you. I was thinking about a caller the other day who was asking me about what some of these COVID restrictions have done to and meant for our youth, children. How have they handled it? Not only just the disruption in their educational lives and their social lives, the masking issues, travel issues, seeing grandparents issues, church issues. And I went through some of that, and I've been going through some of that, and we've been talking about some of that. But it also dawned on me, where is the literature right now on what woke schooling is doing to our children? What the pressure on children to learn racism and anti-racism memes is doing to them? What the teaching of the Black Lives Matter curricula is doing for them, what the focus on whiteness is doing to them, what the pressure about transgenderism and instruction in transgenderism is doing to them. And I found it. I found one, at least, by a Dr. Lewis Andrews. Dr. Lewis Andrews is writing in Real Clear Policy. He writes, and this is really good. I'm going to spend some time with it. The anti-racism curricula increasingly adopted by America's K-12 schools contains so much misinformation that the growing backlash against them has predictably focused on course content, teaching children that the U.S. Constitution was designed by whites to enslave minorities, that modern scientific concepts are tainted by racism, that right math answers are a slight to people of color, and that the classics of Western literature should be replaced by social justice theory, is not how most parents think their children ought to be educated. Unfortunately, the outrage over subject matter has led even thoughtful observers to overlook the fact that woke curricula involve much more than warped views of history or science and social relations. They also employ instructional methods that have been shown to inflict serious psychological harm completely independent of what is being taught. In other words, regardless of the content. These include the frequent uses of shaming, forced public confessions of so-called privilege, the acceptance of one's socioeconomic background as an excuse for not achieving, and the promotion of ideological conformity as the best way to deal with social conflict. To appreciate just how emotionally damaging these methods can be, it is worth thinking back to a time, not that long ago, when every education graduate school impressed its teachers in training with the importance of building a youngster's what? Self-esteem, right? Even those professors who felt the K-12 grade classroom should be used in a more systematic way to improve race relations still understood the importance of nurturing each student's faith in him or herself. If sociological research had proved anything, it was the connection between developing self-confidence in childhood and later adult success. Sadly, today's woke curricula do far more to erode a child's intrinsic sense of worth than to build it up. Indeed, one can hardly imagine a more effective way of grooming disorganized and incompetent adults. As one veteran teacher in the public school system recently put it, anti-racist classrooms have devolved into little more than a series of scoldings, guilt trips, and demands to demean oneself simply to make another feel empowered. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. Particularly worrisome from a clinical perspective is the systemic use of shaming to make even the youngest students feel personally responsible for events over which they had no control. As an August issue last year of the Scientific American reported, people who are deliberately shamed, even over a modest violation of social norms, are at a much greater risk for depression and anxiety disorders. They are also more inclined to avoid close relationships and suppress emotions, even decades after some humiliating event. I can come back to that too. Those who have been repeatedly shamed for any reason, it turns out, are significantly less likely to possess the risk-taking habits required for adult success. Fearing any future might lead others to further devalue them, they only venture those things which seem guaranteed to end well. According to a recent study in the Journal of Psychology, some are permanently incapacitated by feelings of inferiority, hopelessness, and helplessness. It should be no surprise, then, that school-aged children are especially vulnerable to socially induced humiliation. Because the identities of younger people are not completely formed, their uncertainty about how to deal with the expectations of others makes them hypersensitive to being judged. This fact has been apparent for years when it comes to internet bullying, but the high-minded social justice rhetoric typically used to justify woke curricula has unfortunately persuaded many of us to overlook what Carl Jung once called the soul-eating consequences of artificially induced guilt. While some might argue that gambling with the emotional well-being of America's children is an acceptable risk to take for the goal of ending racism, the evidence to date suggests that classroom shaming is just as likely to cause discrimination as it is to cure it. Shame is the ultimate divider, says one psychologist. It's a me versus them feeling, a deliberate act to cause one to feel like an outsider. As a finger-pointing gesture, it can easily induce the very reverse of what was intended. New York Times and Washington Post health reporter Ashley Abramson agrees, noting that a growing number of professionals have expressed serious reservations about the way Americans are trying to deal with the legacy of racism. While a healthy dose of guilt over the collective role in anti-black racism can motivate people to listen, learn, and do better, experts say wallowing in shame can accomplish the opposite. We are creating, in other words, folks, a new generation of racialized and racist Americans. I want to read you more from this and circle back on a few things when we come back as well. 602-508-0960. Be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. 602-508-0960. I'm reading this piece in Real Clear Policy by Dr. Leslie Andrews, and it's about the psychological effects of the woke curricula, or at least the woke teaching. that is taking place in our K through 12 schools. We've talked a lot here about the psychological impacts on children of COVID mediation strategies, not really nearly enough about what the woke curricula and pedagogical instrumentalities that flow from it have done to the psychology of our young children. The use of shaming and other confidence-destroying techniques to remold a child's personality is concerning enough under the supervision of a licensed professional, but woke curricula are typically implemented by teachers with no clinical experience in mental health. Worse still, their work is often performed without any regard for the legitimate concern of the student's parents, of the child's parents. At Seattle's Magnolia Elementary School, for example, kindergarten to fifth graders instructed were told to read books touching on racial inequality and then prompted to reveal their subsequent feelings in group. The principal there proudly concedes that Magnolia's methods form an outlook, quote, that may be different than their home culture, but has no problem with the idea of making, quote, anti-racist kids at school, whether they live in an anti-racist home or not, close quote. Christopher Rufo at the City Journal says that in the Buffalo Public School curriculum, kindergarten teachers have students compare their skin colors to crayons and then watch a video of dead black children speaking to them from beyond the grave about racist police and state-sanctioned violence. By the time these same children get to fifth grade, they have been taught to regard the larger society as a school-to-grave pipeline for black children and a place where at any given moment 1 million minority adults are locked in cages, psychologically disturbing views not likely shared by every parent. Even school districts that appear to be reaching out for community input are not really doing so. The Education Board in Reading, Connecticut, has joined with the Board of Easton to form a Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Task Force. This committee has in turn charged itself with doing what many similar groups across America have done in recent years, design surveys of local students and parents, the results of which will presumably be used to improve the curriculum. But never do any of these efforts include consultation with an experienced opinion researcher who can surface hidden agendas, ensure that the results are fairly interpreted, and certify that the classroom changes are as humane as they are ideological. How much psychological damage today's woke curricula have already inflicted on America's school children is something we are unlikely to ever document with any precision. Given the progressive pressure that university researchers currently operate under, no academic is going to risk his or her professional career to answer such a question. What we do know, as former New York Times writer Barry Weiss recently observed, is that the progressive ideology at the heart of woke schooling relies on some remarkably callous tactics. Persuasion is replaced with public shaming. Forgiveness is replaced with punishment. Mercy is replaced with vengeance. Pluralism with conformity. Debate with deplatforming. Facts with feelings. Ideas with identity. We also know that if teachers do have any documented therapeutic competence, it is the ability to provide a nurturing environment for at-risk children. Studies show that educators who can form a trusting relationship with their students are able to enthuse even students from broken, unstable, and foster homes. Unfortunately, this kind of non-judgmental encouragement is the very opposite of how ideologically driven anti-racist curricula expect the modern educators to behave. Whether one believes America was founded in 1776 or in 1619, it is important to recognize the enormous psychological risk anti-racist education is taking with young lives. Separate from inaccuracies that may be claimed with respect to American history, woke curricula dabble far too close to psychiatric malpractice for any loving parent's comfort. Think about that when you think about the woke curricula and what it does to a child when it comes to turning to the use of shaming and other confidence-destroying techniques. when it comes to finger pointing, when it comes to separating. Think about what that does to a children's psychology, to make them see a life of mercy replaced with vengeance and pluralism with conformity. Be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. We'll see how much coverage, good question from Dana, how much coverage the shooting in Frederick, Maryland, how much news it gets. It's fraught with all the usual things the left usually wants to say about a shooting versus the facts, which is everything the left wishes weren't the truth. In other words, an assailant that doesn't fit their narrative, so probably, or an alleged assailant, so probably won't get that kind of coverage. You see the kinds of shootings that took place in Atlanta are the only kinds of shootings they care about. Do we know anything about the shooting of the woman who was killed on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol? Shot in the back? We don't. We don't know anything about who shot her. We're still pretty much not sure about anything having to do with the death of the U.S. Capitol policeman. And we have, at the same time, two teen girls who kill an Uber driver getting no criminal sentence beyond the age of 21. These are the wages. These are the wages of the woke criminal justice system. The color of your skin matters depending on who's the assailant and who's the victim. And it's not ever, ever going to be consistent. For a victim to matter, they have to be of one race only if and only if the assailant is of a certain different race, and vice versa. What a degrading of the human character and the idea of what a human being is. What a terrible, terrible lesson, not only to children, but to the rest of the country and world, that certain races will get certain privileges in the criminal court system and in the charging system based on the race of the person they assaulted or killed. It's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing when you think about the entirety of the history of law having to do with criminal procedure, particularly in Fourth and Fifth Amendment and 14th, sometimes 14th Amendment cases. And it's a terrible message about the value of life. The value of life, which can increase evidently and decrease when it's taken, not based on the kind of life lived by the person whose life was taken, but by the kind of race the person who killed them obtains, adheres to, has. What a terrible way to judge the import of a human life. Do we all not bleed? Do we all not have the same feelings? Do we all not blush? As William Shakespeare put it. Of course we do. In The Merchant of Venice, of course we do. It's just that the modern woke don't believe that. They do literally believe that not just certain lives should be elevated to mattering like every other life, as you might infer from a meaning of BLM. They mean something much different. They don't mean to recognize lives that haven't been recognized and put it on par with the rest of society. They mean to put the rest of society below par. Below par. And just reverse the inequality that they perceive exists. It's a very, very, very dangerous road to go down when you start blaming entire races for a problem, and when you start excusing other races for never being part of it. It's called Collective Guilt and Guilt by Association. And it's led to some of the worst crimes against humanity in this country. It's a terrible thing. I was gratified to hear earlier, I think it was on Dennis Prager's show, that the Uber driver's GoFundMe account is raising a good amount of money, a good amount of money, so that the family can pay for his burial and funeral needs. This Indian driver, Uber driver, Muhammad Anwar, killed by those two teen girls. But then Dennis asked a really interesting question. He says, there's no way to ever know. But if you want to know about the goodness of America, think about what was the predominant race of the people who donated to Muhammad Anwar's GoFundMe account. It's a halting thought, isn't it? Because you know as well as I do, as well as that the sun will set tonight and rise again tomorrow, that it was mostly Caucasian Americans who did that. The systemically racist society. And his killers will not be in prison and will not serve time in their adulthood. Really, really quite astounding. Really quite astounding. When individuals in this country and organizations and movements in this country have to do the work the government used to be charged with. Individuals have to associate collectively now to do that which government should have been doing. Things like true equality and racial justice. The government is aiding in the perversion of it. It's aiding in the exacerbation of it. The healing is coming from, and the good deeds you see taking place in this country are coming from individual citizens who despise, by the way, despise the fact that they are told they're the racists, or they live in a country of institutional racism, because they know they do not. And they act that way every day, while the government acts as if we are a racialized society every single day. Every single day. One wonders what the outcome, and one shudders at what the outcome of the trial in Minneapolis is going to produce. There was a spokesman from BLM today who said, if Derek Chauvin isn't convicted, the city will burn. Well, I posit the question of Keith Ellison being in charge of the prosecution when they overcharged him. I just have to wonder. Was it a deliberate strategy to overcharge so that the city would burn? I'm forced to ask it. I'm Seth. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. The Hallmans will be in the house in about 10 minutes or so, a little less. You all hopefully are aware of the treatment 60 Minutes gave to Ron DeSantis. No 60 Minutes investigation into the goings-on of the governor of New York or California, but Ron DeSantis, they put in their crosshairs. And Charlie Cook over at NR writes, the American media is likely unsalvageable because whatever happens, it remains entirely unable to grasp why people dislike it so much. Take, by example, Axios's summary of Sunday's 60 Minutes. It writes, and they write in Axios, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Trump ally with his eyes on the White House, is dialing up a dispute with 60 Minutes, seizing on a juicy chance to ingratiate himself with the GOP base by bashing the media. That's the story, is it? That DeSantis is seizing on CBS's world-class dishonesty? The issue here is his reaction to being so brazenly lied about? The need to know Pressy is that he's annoyed by the press's penchant for deliberately spreading baseless conspiracy theories, that he might bash those who did it, that he's been accorded a juicy chance to highlight bad behavior. Just look at the Why It Matters summary that Axios also put up. It says it matters because it's a political gift, akin to all the Fox fodder that Senator Tom Cotton gobbled up after the New York Times revolted over his op-ed. Evidently, it is the considered opinion of Axios that what matters here is not that CBS's flagship news show has exhibited such unyielding corruption that it has been called out as such by prominent Democrats even, but that CBS's egregious conduct has presented its victim with a political gift. The first step to reform is admitting you have a problem, and the press simply can't do it. Hell, even rival outlets are unprepared to do it to each other, unless, of course, they're taking shots at Fox. Every time this happens, the press withers a little more on the vine. It'll notice eventually what they've done to themselves. But by then, hopefully, it'll be too late. I'm Seth. We'll be right back.